On the train the next day, Joe didn't make many speeches with rhymes to her, but he bought her the best things the butcher had, like apples and a glass lantern full of candies. Mostly he talked about plans for the town when he got there. They were bound to need somebody like him. Janie took a lot of looks at him, and she was proud of what she saw. Kind of portly like rich white folks. Strange trains and people and places didn't scare him neither. When they got off the train at Maitland, he found a buggy to carry them over to the colored town right away. It was early in the afternoon when they got there, so Joe said they must walk over the place and look around. They locked arms and strolled from end to end of the town. Joe noted the scant dozen of shame-faced houses scattered in the sand and palmetto roots and said, "God, they call this a town? Why, it ain't nothing but a raw place in the woods." "It's a whole heap littler than I thought," Janie admitted her disappointment. "Just like I thought," Joe said. "A whole heap of talk and nobody doing nothing. My God, where's the mayor?" he asked somebody. "I want to speak with the mayor." Two men who were sitting on their shoulder blades under a huge live oak tree almost sat upright at the tone of his voice. They stared at Joe's face, his clothes, and his wife. "Where y'all come from in such a big haste?" Lee Coker asked. "Middle Georgie," Starks answered briskly. "Joe Starks is my name, from in and through Georgie." "You and your daughter gonna join with us in fellowship?" the other reclining figure asked. "Mighty glad to have you. Hicks is the name. Governor Amos Hicks from Beaufort, South Carolina. Free, single, disengaged." "My God, I ain't nowhere near old enough to have no grown daughter. This here's my wife." Hicks sank back and lost interest at once. "Where's the mayor?" Starks persisted. I wants to talk with him." "You's a mite too previous for that," Coker told him. "Us ain't got none yet." "Ain't got no mayor? Well, who tells y'all what to do?" "Nobody. Everybody's grown, and then again, I reckon us just ain't thought about it. I know I ain't." "I did think about it one day," Hicks said dreamily, "but then I forgot it and ain't thought about it since then." "No wonder things ain't no better," Joe commented. "I'm buying in here, and buying in big. Soon as we find some place to sleep tonight, us men folks got to call people together and form a committee. Then we can get things moving around here." "I can point you where you can sleep," Hicks offered. "Man got his house done built, and his wife ain't come yet." Starks and Janie moved off in the direction indicated, with Hicks and Coker boring into their backs with looks. "That man talks like a section foreman," Coker commented. "He's mighty compelment." "Shucks," said Hicks. "My bridges is just as long as his. But that wife of his, I'm a son of a compunction if I don't go to Georgia and get me one just like her." "What with?" "With my talk, man. It takes money to feed pretty women. They gets a lavish of talk." "Not like mine. They love to hear me talk because they can't understand it. My cold talking is too deep, too much cold to it." "You don't believe me, do you? You don't know the women I can get to my command." "You ain't never seen me when I'm out pleasuring and giving pleasure." "It's a good thing he married her before she seen me. I can be some trouble when I take a notion." "I'm a bitch's baby around lady people. I'd much rather see all that than to hear about it. Come on, let's go see what he gonna do about this town." They got up and sauntered over to where Starks was living for the present. Already the town had found the strangers. Joe was on the porch, talking to a small group of men. Janie could be seen through the bedroom window, getting settled. Joe had rented the house for a month. The men were all around him, and he was talking to them by asking questions. What's the real name of the place? Some say West Maitland, and some say Eatonville. That's cause Cap'n Eaton give us some land along with Mr. Lawrence, but Cap'n Eaton give the first piece. How much they give? Oh, about 50 acres. How much has y'all got now? Oh, about the same. That ain't near enough. Who owns the land joining on to what you got? Cap'n Eaton? Well, where is this Cap'n Eaton? Over there in Maitland, except when he go visiting or something. Let me speak to my wife a minute, and I'm going to see the man. You cannot have no town without some land to build it on. Y'all ain't got enough here to cuss a cat on without getting a mouthful of hair. He ain't got no more land to give away. You need plenty of money if you wants any more. I expects to pay him. The idea was funny to them, and they wanted to laugh. They tried hard to hold it in, but enough incredulous laughter burst out of their eyes and leaked from the corners of their mouths to inform anyone of their thoughts. So Joe walked off abruptly. Most of them went along to show him the way and to be there when his bluff was called. Hicks didn't go far. He turned back to the house as soon as he felt he wouldn't be missed from the crowd and mounted the porch.
Evening, Miss Starks.
Good evening.
You reckon you going to like round here?
I reckon so.
Anything I can do to help out, why, you can call on me.
Much obliged. There was a long, dead pause. Janie was not jumping at her chance like she ought to. Looked like she didn't hardly know he was there. She needed waking up.
Folks must be mighty closed-mouthed where you come from.
That's right, but it must be different at your home. He was a long time thinking, but finally he saw and stumbled down the steps with a surly,
"Bye."
"Goodbye."
That night, Coker asked him about it.
"I saw you when you ducked back into Stark's house."
"Well, how did you make out?"
"Who, me? I ain't been near the place, man. I've been down to the lake trying to catch me a fish."
"Hmm.
That woman ain't so awfully pretty, nohow, when you take the second look at her. I had to sort of pass by the house on the way back and seen her good. Tain't nothing to her except that long hair."
"Hmm.
And anyhow, I done took a liking to the man. I wouldn't harm him at all. She ain't half as pretty as a gal I run off and left up in South Carolina."
"Hicks, I'd get mad and say you was lying if I didn't know you so good. You just talking to consolate yourself by word of mouth. You got a willing mind, but you too light behind. A whole heap of men seen the same thing you seen, but they got better sense than you. Now, you ought to know you can't take no woman like that from no man like him. A man that ups and buys 200 acres of land at one whack and pays cash for it?
No, he didn't buy it sure enough. He sure did. Come off with the papers in his pocket. He done called a meeting on his porch tomorrow. Ain't never seen no such a colored man before in all my born days. He's going to put up a store and get a post office from the government."
That irritated Hicks, and he didn't know why. He was the average mortal. It troubled him to get used to the world one way and then suddenly have it turn different. He wasn't ready to think of colored people in post offices yet. He laughed boisterously.
"Y'all let that stray donkey tell y'all any old lie. A colored man sitting up in a post office."
He made an obscene sound.
He's liable to do it too, Hicks. I hope so anyhow. Us colored folks are too envious of one another. That's how come us don't get no farther than us do. Us talks about the white man keeping us down. Shucks! He don't have to. Us keeps our own selves down.
Now, who said I didn't want the man to get us a post office? He can be the king of Jerusalem for all I care. Still and all, tain't no use in telling lies just because a heap of folks don't know no better. Your common sense ought to tell you the white folks ain't gonna allow him to run no post office. That we don't know, Hicks. He say he can't, and I believe he know what he's talking about. Now, I reckon if colored folks got their own town, they can have post office and whatsoever they please, regardless. And then again, I don't expect the white folks way off yonder. Give a damn. Let's just wait and see. Oh, I'm waiting all right. Expects to keep on waiting till hell freeze over. Oh, get reconciled. That woman don't want you. You got to learn that all the women in the world ain't been brought up on no Tepentine steel and no sawmill camp. There's some women that just ain't for you to broach. You can't get up with no fish sandwich. They argued a bit more, then went on to the house where Joe was and found him in his shirt sleeves, standing with his legs wide apart, asking questions and smoking a cigar. "Where's the closest sawmill?" he was asking Tony Taylor. "About 7 miles gone towards Apopka," Tony told him. "Thinking about building right away?" "My God, yeah, but not the house I expects to live in. That can wait till I make up my mind where I want to locate it. I figures we all needs a store in a big hurry." "A store?" Tony shouted in surprise. "Yeah, a store right here in town with everything in it you need. 'Tain't a bit of use in everybody progging way over to Maitland to buy a little meal and flour when they could get it right here." "That would be kind of nice, Brother Stark, since you mention it." "I God, of course it would. And then again, a store is good in other ways. I got to have a place to be at when folks come to buy land. And furthermore, everything's got to have a center and a heart to it. And the town ain't no different from nowhere else. It would be natural for the store to be meeting place for the town." "That sure is the truth now. Oh, we'll have this town all fixed up directly. Don't miss being at the meeting tomorrow." Just about time for the committee meeting called to meet on his porch next day, the first wagon load of lumber drove up, and Jody went to show them where to put it, told Janie to hold the committee there until he got back. He didn't want to miss them, but he meant to count every foot of that lumber before it touched the ground. He could have saved his breath, and Janie could have kept right on with what she was doing. In the first place, everybody was late in coming. Then, the next thing, as soon as they heard where Jody was, they kept right on up there where the new lumber was rattling off the wagon and being piled under the big live oak tree. So that's where the meeting was held, with Tony Taylor acting as chairman and Jody doing all the talking. A day was named for roads, and they all agreed to bring axes and things like that and chop out 2 roads running each way. That applied to everybody except Tony and Coker. They could carpenter. So Jody hired them to go to work on his store bright and soon the next morning. Jody himself would be busy driving around from town to town telling people about Edenville and drumming up citizens to move there. Janie was astonished to see the money Jody had spent for the land come back to him so fast. 10 new families bought lots and moved to town in 6 weeks. It all looked too big and rushing for her to keep track of. Before the store had a complete roof, Jody had canned goods piled on the floor and was selling so much he didn't have time to go off on his talking tours. She had her first taste of presiding over it the day it was complete and finished. Jody told her to dress up and stand in the store all that evening. Everybody was coming sort of fixed up, and he didn't mean for nobody else's wife to rank with her. She must look on herself as the bell cow. The other women were the gang. So she put on one of her bought dresses and went up the new cut road, all dressed in wine-colored red. Her silken ruffles rustled and muttered about her. The other women had on percale and calico, with here and there a head rag among the older ones. Nobody was buying anything that night. They didn't come there for that.
they had come to make a welcome. So Joe knocked in the head of a barrel of soda crackers and cut some cheese.
Everybody, come right forward and make merry. I got it. It's my treat. Jody gave one of his big hey-hey laughs and stood back. Janie dipped up the lemonade like he told her. A big tin cupful for everybody. Tony Taylor felt so good when it was all gone that he felt to make a speech.
Ladies and gentlemen, we've come together and gathered here to welcome to our midst one who has seen fit to cast in his lot amongst us. He didn't just come himself, neither. He have seen fit to bring his, the light of his home, that is his wife, amongst us also. She couldn't look no more better and no nobler if she was the Queen of England. It's a pleasure for her to be here amongst us. Brother Starks, we welcome you and all that you have seen fit to bring amongst us. Your beloved wife, your store, your land. A big mouthed burst of laughter cut him short. That'll do, Tony, Lige Moss yelled out. Mr. Starks is a smart man. We's all willing to acknowledge to that. But the day he come wagging down the road with 200 acres of land over his shoulders, I wants to be there to see it.
Another big blowout of a laugh. Tony was a little peeved at having the one speech of his lifetime ruined like that.
All y'all know what was meant. I don't see how come...
Because you jump up to make speeches and don't know how, Lige said.
I was speaking just all right before you stuck your bill in.
No, you wasn't, Tony. You way out of jurisdiction. You can't welcome a man and his wife without you make comparisons about Isaac and Rebecca at the well, else it don't show the love between them if you don't.
Everybody agreed that that was right. It was sort of pitiful for Tony not to know he couldn't make a speech without saying that. Some tittered at his ignorance, so Tony said testily,
If all them that's going to cut the monkey and done cut it and threw it, we'll thank Brother Starks for a respond.
So Joe Starks and his cigar took the center of the floor.
I thank you all for your kind welcome and for extending to me the right hand of fellowship. I can see that this town is full of union and love. I mean to put my hands to the plow here and strain every nerve to make this our town the metropolis of the state. So maybe I better tell you in case you don't know that if we expect to move on, us got to incorporate like every other town. Us got to incorporate and us got to have a mayor if things is to be done and done right. I welcome y'all on behalf of me and my wife to this store and to the other things to come. Amen.
Tony led the loud hand clapping and was out in the center of the floor when it stopped.
Brothers and sisters, since us can't never expect to better our choice, I move that we make Brother Starks our mayor until we can see further.
Second that motion.
It was everybody talking at once, so there was no need of putting it to a vote.
And now we'll listen to a few words of encouragement from Mrs. Mayor Starks.
The burst of applause was cut short by Joe taking the floor himself.
Thank you for your compliments, but my wife don't know nothing about no speech making. I never married her for nothing like that. She's a woman, and her place is in the home.
Janie made her face laugh after a short pause, but it wasn't too easy. She had never thought of making a speech and didn't know if she cared to make one at all. It must have been the way Joe spoke out without giving her a chance to say anything one way or another that took the bloom off of things. But anyway, she went down the road behind him that night, feeling cold. He strode along, invested with his new dignity, thought, and planned out loud, unconscious of her thoughts.
The mayor of a town like this can't lay around home too much. The place needs building up. Janie, I'll get hold of somebody to help out in the store, and you can look after things whilst I drum up things otherwise.
Oh, Jody, I can't do nothing with no stove less than you's there. I could maybe come in and help you when things get rushed, but, my God, I don't see how come you can't. There ain't nothing at all to hinder you if you got a thimble full of sense. You got to. I got too much else on my hands as mayor. This town needs some light right now. It is a little dark right along here. Of course it is. There ain't no use in scuffling over all these stumps and roots in the dark. I'll call a meeting about the dark and the roots right away. I'll sit on this case first thing. The very next day, with money out of his own pocket, he sent off to Sears Roebuck and Company for the street lamp and told the town to meet the following Thursday night to vote on it. Nobody had ever thought of street lamps, and some of them said it was a useless notion. They went so far as to vote against it, but the majority ruled. But the whole town got vain over it after it came. That was because the mayor didn't just take it out of the crate and stick it up on a post. He unwrapped it and had it wiped off carefully and put it up on a showcase for a week for everybody to see. Then he set a time for the lighting and sent word all around Orange County for one and all to come to the lamp lighting. He sent men out to the swamp to cut the finest and the straightest cypress post they could find and kept on sending them back to hunt another one until they found one that pleased him. He had talked to the people already about the hospitality of the occasion. "Y'all know we can't invite people to our town just dry along so. I God, no. We got to feed them something. And 'tain't nothing people likes better than barbecue. I'll get one whole hog my own self. Seem like all the rest of y'all put together ought to be able to scrape up two more. I tell your women folks to do round about some pies and cakes and sweet potato pone.' That's the way it went, too. The women got together the sweets, and the men looked after the meats. The day before the lighting, they dug a big hole in back of the store and filled it full of oak wood and burned it down to a glowing bed of coals. It took them the whole night to barbecue the three hogs. Hambo and Pearson had full charge while the others helped out with turning the meat now and then, while Hambo swabbed it all over with the sauce. In between times, they told stories, laughed and told more stories, and sung songs. They cut all sorts of capers and whiffed the meat as it slowly came to perfection with the seasoning penetrating to the bone. The younger boys had to rig up the sawhorses with boards for the women to use as tables. Then it was after sunup, and everybody not needed went home to rest up for the feast. By 5 o'clock, the town was full of every kind of a vehicle and swarming with people. They wanted to see that lamp lit at dusk. Near the time, Joe assembled everybody in the street before the store and made a speech. "Folks, the sun is going down. The sunmaker brings it up in the morning, and the sunmaker sends it to bed at night. Us poor weak humans can't do nothing to hurry it up nor to slow it down. All we can do, if we want any light after the setting or before the rising, is to make some light ourselves. So that's how come lamps was made. This evening, we's all assembled here to light a lamp. This occasion is something for us all to remember to our dying day. The first street lamp in a colored town. Lift your eyes and gaze on it. And when I touch the match to that lamp wick, let the light penetrate inside of you. And let it shine, let it shine, let it shine. Brother Davis, lead us in a word of prayer. Ask a blessing on this town in a most particular manner." While Davis chanted a traditional prayer poem with his own variations, Joe mounted the box that had been placed for the purpose and opened the brazen door of the lamp. As the word "Amen" was said, he touched the lighted match to the wick, and Mrs. Bogle's alto burst out in,
We'll walk in the light, the beautiful light. Come where the dewdrops of mercy shine bright. Shine all around us by day and by night. Jesus, the light of the world. They, all of them, all of the people, took it up and sang it over and over till it was wrung dry and no further innovations of tone and tempo were conceivable. Then they hushed and ate barbecue. When it was all over, that night in bed, Jody asked Janie, "Well, honey, how you like being Mrs. Mayor?"
"It's all right, I reckon. But don't you think it keeps us in a kind of strain?"
"Strain? You mean the cooking and waiting on folks?"
"No, Jody. It just looks like it keeps us in some way we ain't natural with one another. You's always off talking and fixing things, and I feels like I'm just marking time. Hope it soon gets over."
"Over, Janie? My God, I ain't even started good. I told you in the very first beginning that I aim to be a big voice. You ought to be glad, because that makes a big woman out of you."
A feeling of coldness and fear took hold of her. She felt far away from things and lonely. Janie soon began to feel the impact of awe and envy against her sensibilities. The wife of the mayor was not just another woman, as she had supposed. She slept with authority, and so she was part of it in the town mind. She couldn't get but so close to most of them in spirit. It was especially noticeable after Joe had forced through a town ditch to drain the street in front of the store. They had murmured hotly about slavery being over, but every man filled his assignment. There was something about Joe Starks that cowed the town. It was not because of physical fear. He was no fist fighter. His bulk was not even imposing as men go. Neither was it because he was more literate than the rest. Something else made men give way before him. He had a bow-down command in his face, and every step he took made the thing more tangible. Take, for instance, that new house of his. It had two stories, with porches, with banisters and such things. The rest of the town looked like servants' quarters surrounding the big house. And different from everybody else in the town, he put off moving in until it had been painted in and out. And look at the way he painted it, a gloaty, sparkly white, the kind of promenading white that the houses of Bishop Whipple, W.B. Jackson, and the Vanderpools wore. It made the village feel funny talking to him, just like he was anybody else. Then there was a matter of the spittoons. No sooner was he all set as the mayor, postmaster, landlord, storekeeper, then he bought a desk like Mr. Hill or Mr. Galloway over in Maitland with one of those swing-around chairs to it. What with him biting down on cigars and saving his breath on talk and swinging around in that chair, it weakened people. And then he spit in that gold-looking vase that anybody else would have been glad to put on their front room table. Said it was a spittoon, just like his used-to-be boss man used to have in his bank up there in Atlanta. Didn't have to get up and go to the door every time he had to spit. Didn't spit on his floor, neither. Had that golded-up spitting pot right handy. But he went further than that. He bought a little lady-sized spitting pot for Janie to spit in. Had it right in the parlor with little sprigs of flowers painted all around the sides. It took people by surprise because most of the women dipped snuff and, of course, had a spit cup in the house. But how could they know up-to-date folks were spitting in flowery little things like that? It sort of made the rest of them feel that they had been taken advantage of, like things had been kept from them.
maybe more things in the world besides spitting pots had been hid from them when they wasn't told no better than to spit in tomato cans. It was bad enough for white people, but when one of your own color could be so different, it put you on a wonder. It was like seeing your sister turn into a gator, a familiar strangeness. You kept seeing your sister in the gator and the gator in your sister, and you'd rather not. There was no doubt that the town respected him and even admired him in a way. But any man who walks in the way of power and property is bound to meet hate. So when speakers stood up when the occasion demanded and said, "Our beloved mayor," it was one of those statements that everybody says, but nobody actually believes, like, "God is everywhere." It was just a handle to wind up the tongue with. As time went on, and the benefits he had conferred upon the town receded in time, they sat on his store porch while he was busy inside and discussed him. Like one day after he caught Henry Pitts with a wagon load of his ribbon cane and took the cane away from Pitts and made him leave town. Some of them thought Starks ought not to have done that. He had so much cane and everything else. But they didn't say that while Joe Starks was on the porch. When the mail came from Maitland and he went inside to sort it out, everybody had their say. Sim Jones started off as soon as he was sure that Starks couldn't hear him. "It's a sin and a shame running that poor man away from here like that. Colored folks oughtn't to be so hard on one another." "I don't see it that way at all," Sam Watson said shortly. "Let colored folks learn to work for what they get like everybody else. Nobody ain't stopped Pitts from planting the cane he wanted to. Starks give him a job. What more do he want?" "I know that too," Jones said. "But Sam, Joe Starks is too exact with folks. All he got, he done made it off of the rest of us. He didn't have all that when he come here." "Yeah, but none of all this you see and you setting on wasn't here neither when he come. Give the devil his due. But now, Sam, you know that all he do is big belly around and tell other folks what to do. He loves obedience out of everybody under the sound of his voice. You can feel a switch in his hand when he's talking to you," Oscar Scott complained. "That chastising feeling he totes sort of gives you the protolapsus of the quaternary lining." "He's a whirlwind among breezes," Jeff Bruce threw in. "Speaking of winds, he's the wind and we's the grass. We bend whichever way he blows," Sam Watson agreed. "But at that, us needs him. The town wouldn't be nothing if it wasn't for him. He can't help being sort of bossy. Some folks needs thrones and ruling chairs and crowns to make their influence felt. He don't. He got a throne in the seat of his pants. What I don't like about the man is he talks to unlettered folks with books in his jaws," Hicks complained, "showing off his learning. To look at me, you wouldn't take it, but I got a brother passing up around O'Connor that got good learning. If he was here, Joe Starks wouldn't make no fool out of him like he do the rest of y'all. I often wonder how that little wife of his makes out with him, because he's a man that changes everything, but nothing don't change him. You know, many's the time I done thought about that myself. He gets on her every now and then when she make little mistakes around the store. What makes her keep her head tied up like some old woman around the store? Nobody couldn't get me to tie no rag on my head if I had hair like that. Maybe he make her do it. Maybe he scared some of the rest of us men might touch it around that store. It sure is a hidden mystery to me. She sure don't talk much. The way he rears and pitches in the stove sometimes when she make a mistake is sort of ungodly, but she don't seem to mind at all. Reckon they understand one another." The town had a basket full of feelings, good and bad, about Joe's positions and possessions, but none had the temerity to challenge him. They bowed down to him, rather, because he was all of these things. And then again,
he was all of these things because the town bowed down. Every morning, the world flung itself over and exposed the town to the sun. So Janie had another day, and every day had a store in it, except Sundays. The store itself was a pleasant place, if only she didn't have to sell things. When the people sat around on the porch and passed around the pictures of their thoughts for the others to look at and see, it was nice. The fact that the thought pictures were always crayon enlargements of life made it even nicer to listen to. Take, for instance, the case of Matt Bonner's Yellow Mule. They had him up for conversation every day the Lord sent, most especially if Matt was there himself to listen. Sam and Lige and Walter were the ringleaders of the mule talkers. The others threw in whatever they could chance upon. But it seemed as if Sam and Lige and Walter could hear and see more about that mule than the whole county put together. All they needed was to see Matt's long, spare shape coming down the street, and by the time he got to the porch, they were ready for him. "Hello, Matt."
"Evening, Sam."
"Mighty glad you come along right now, Matt. Me and some others was just about to come hunt you."
"What for, Sam?"
"Mighty serious matter, man, serious." "Yeah, man," Lige would cut in dolefully. "It needs your strict attention. You ought not to lose no time."
"What is it, then? You ought to hop and tell me."
"Reckon we better not tell you here in the store. It's too far off to do any good. We better all walk on down by Lake Sebelia."
"What's wrong, man? I ain't after none of y'all's foolishness now."
"That mule of yourn, Matt. You better go see about him. He's bad off."
"Whereabouts? Did he wade in the lake and an alligator catch him?"
"Worse than that. The women folks got your mule. When I come round the lake about noontime, my wife and some others had him flat on the ground, using his sides for a washboard."
The great clap of laughter that they had been holding in bursts out. Sam never cracks a smile.
"Yeah, Matt, that mule's so skinny till the women is using his rib bones for a rub board and hanging things out on his hock bones to dry."
Matt realizes that they have tricked him again, and the laughter makes him mad. And when he gets mad, he stammers.
"Use a stinking lie, Sam, and your feet ain't mates. You.
Oh, man, they no using you getting mad. You know you don't feed the mule. How ain't gonna get fat?"
I does feed him. I give him a full cup of corn every feeding."
"Lies knows all about that cup of corn. He hid round your barn and watched you. Tain't no feed cup you measures that corn out of. It's a teacup."
"I does feed him. He just too mean for to get fat. He stay poor and raw bony just for spite. He's scared he'll have to work some."
"Yeah, you feeds him. Feed him off a come up and season it with rawhide."
"Does feed the ornery varmint. Don't care what I do, I can't get along with him. He fights every inch in front of the plow and even lay back his ears to kick and bite when I go into the stall to feed him."
"Get reconciled, Matt," Lige soothed. "Us all knows he's mean. I seen him when he took after one of them robbers chilling in the street and would have caught him and maybe trampled him to death if the wind hadn't changed all of a sudden. You see, the young'un was trying to make it to the fence of Starks' onion patch, and the mule was dead in behind him and gaining on him every jump. When all of a sudden, the wind changed and blowed the mule way off his course, him being so poor and everything, and before the ornery varmint could tack, the young'un had done got over the fence."
The porch laughed, and Matt got mad again.
Maybe the mule takes out after everybody, Sam said, because he thinks everybody he hear coming is Matt Bonner coming to work him on an empty stomach. Oh, no, 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 no. You stop that right now, Walter objected. That mule don't think I look like no Matt Bonner. He ain't that dumb. If I thought he didn't know no better, I'd have my pixie took and give it to that mule so she could learn better. I ain't gonna allow him to hold nothing like that against me. Matt struggled to say something, but his tongue failed him, so he jumped down off the porch and walked away as mad as he could be. But that never halted the mule talk. There would be more stories about how poor the brute was, his age, his evil disposition, and his latest caper. Everybody indulged in mule talk. He was next to the mayor in prominence and made better talking. Janie loved the conversation, and sometimes she thought up good stories on the mule. But Joe had forbidden her to indulge. He didn't want her talking after such trashy people. Use Mrs. Mayor Starks, Janie. My God, I can't see what a woman of your stability would want to be treasuring all that gum grease from folks that don't even own the house they sleep in. They no earthly use. There's just some puny humans playing round the toes of time. Janie noted that while he didn't talk the mule himself, he sat and laughed at it. Laughed his big laugh, too. But then when Lige or Sam or Walter or some of the other big picture talkers were using a side of the world for a canvas, Joe would hustle her off inside the store to sell something. Looked like he took pleasure in doing it. Why couldn't he go himself sometimes? She had come to hate the inside of that store anyway. That post office, too. People always coming and asking for mail at the wrong time. Just when she was trying to count up something or write in an account book. Get her so hackled, she'd make the wrong change for stamps. Then, too, she couldn't read everybody's writing. Some folks wrote so funny and spelt things different from what she knew about. As a rule, Joe put up the mail himself, but sometimes when he was off, she had to do it herself, and it always ended up in a fuss. The store itself kept her with a sick headache. The labor of getting things down off of a shelf or out of a barrel was nothing, and so long as people wanted only a can of tomatoes or a pound of rice, it was all right. But supposing they went on and said, a pound and a half of bacon and a half pound of lard. The whole thing changed from a little walking and stretching to a mathematical dilemma. Or maybe cheese was 37 cents a pound and somebody came and asked for a dime's worth. She went through many silent rebellions over things like that. Such a waste of life and time. But Joe kept saying that she could do it if she wanted to, and he wanted her to use her privileges. That was the rock she was battered against. This business of the head rag irked her endlessly. But Jody was set on it. Her hair was not going to show in the store. It didn't seem sensible at all. That was because Joe never told Janie how jealous he was. He never told her how often he had seen the other men figuratively wallowing in it as she went about things in the store. And one night, he had caught Walter standing behind Janie and brushing the back of his hand back and forth across the loose end of her braid ever so lightly so as to enjoy the feel of it without Janie knowing what he was doing. Joe was at the back of the store and Walter didn't see him. He felt like rushing forth with a meat knife and chopping off the offending hand. That night, he ordered Janie to tie up her hair around the store. That was all.
She was there in the store for him to look at, not those others.
But he never said things like that. It just wasn't in him. Take the matter of the yellow mule, for instance. Late one night, Matt came from the west with a halter in his hand.
"Been hunting for my mule. Anybody seen him?" he asked.
"Seen him soon this morning over behind the schoolhouse," Lum said, "about 10 o'clock or so. He must have been out all night to be way over there that early."
"He was," Matt answered. "Seen him last night, but I couldn't catch him. I'm obliged to get him in tonight, 'cause I got some plowing for tomorrow. Then promised to plow Thompson's Grove."
"Reckon you'd ever get through the job with that mule frame?" Lige asked.
"Oh, that mule is plenty strong, just evil, and don't want to be led."
"That's right. They tell me he brought you here to this town. Say you started to McCanopy, but the mule had better sense and brung you on here."
"It's a lie. I set out for this town when I left West Florida."
"You mean to tell me you rode that mule all the way from West Florida down here?"
"Sure he did lie, but he didn't mean to. He was satisfied up there, but the mule wasn't. So one morning he got straddle the mule, and he took and brought him on off. Mule had sense. Folks up that way don't eat biscuit bread but once a week."
There was always a little seriousness behind the teasing of Matt. So when he got huffed and walked on off, nobody minded. He was known to buy side meat by the slice, carried home little bags of meal and flour in his hand. He didn't seem to mind too much, so long as it didn't cost him anything. About half an hour after he left, they heard the braying of the mule at the edge of the woods. He was coming past the store very soon.
"Let's catch Matt's mule for him and have some fun. Now, Lum, you know that mule ain't aiming to let himself be caught. Let's watch you do it."
When the mule was in front of the store, Lum went out and tackled him. The brute jerked up his head, laid back his ears, and rushed to the attack. Lum had to run for safety. 5 or 6 more men left the porch and surrounded the fractious beast, goosing him in his sides and making him show his temper. But he had more spirit left than body. He was soon panting and heaving from the effort of spinning his old carcass about. Everybody was having fun at the mule baiting, all but Janie. She snatched her head away from the spectacle and began muttering to herself. "They ought to be ashamed of themselves, teasing that poor brute beast like they is. Done been worked to death, done had his disposition ruined with mistreatment, and now they got to finish devilin' him to death. Wished I'd had my way with them all." She walked away from the porch and found something to busy herself with in the back of the store, so she did not hear Jody when he stopped laughing. She didn't know that he had heard her, but she did hear him yell out,
"Lum, I got that's enough. You all done had your fun now. Stop your foolishness and go tell Matt Bonner I want to have a talk with him right away."
Janie came back out front and sat down. She didn't say anything, and neither did Joe. But after a while, he looked down at his feet and said,
"Janie, I reckon you better go fetch me them old black gaiters. These tan shoes sets my feet on fire. Plenty room in them, but they hurts regardless."
She got up without a word and went off for the shoes. A little war of defense for helpless things was going on inside her. People were to have some regard for helpless things. She wanted to fight about it. But I hate disagreement and confusion, so I better not talk. It makes it hard to get along. She didn't hurry back. She fumbled around long enough to get her face straight, and when she got back, Joe was talking with Matt.
$15? My God, you're as crazy as a Betsy bug. $5.
Let's we strike a compromise, Brother Mayor. Let's make it $10.
$5.
Joe rolled his cigar in his mouth and rolled his eyes away indifferently.
If that mule is worth something to you, Brother Mayor, he's worth more to me. More special when I got a job of work tomorrow.
$5.
All right, Brother Mayor, if you wants to rob a poor man like me of everything he got to make a living with, I'll take the $5. That mule been with me 23 years. It's mighty hard.
Mayor Starks deliberately changed his shoes before he reached into his pocket for the money. By that time, Matt was wringing and twisting like a hen on a hot brick. But as soon as his hand closed on the money, his face broke into a grin.
Beat your trading that time, Starks. That mule is liable to be dead before the week is out. You won't get no work out of him.
Didn't buy him for no work. My God, I bought that varmint to let him rest. You didn't have gumption enough to do it.
A respectful silence fell on the place. Sam looked at Joe and said,
"That's a new idea about varmints, Mayor Starks. But I likes it my own self. It's a noble thing you done."
Everybody agreed with that. Janie stood still while they all made comments. When it was all done, she stood in front of Joe and said,
"Jody, that was a mighty fine thing for you to do. 'Tain't everybody would have thought of it. Of course, it ain't no everyday thought. Freeing that mule makes a mighty big man out of you. Something like George Washington and Lincoln, Abraham Lincoln. He had the whole United States to rule, so he freed the Negroes. You got a town, so you freed a mule. You have to have power to free things, and that makes you like a king or something."
Hambo said, "Your wife is a born artist, Starks, or has never knowed that before. She put just the right words to our thoughts." Joe bit down hard on his cigar and beamed all around, but he never said a word. The town talked it for 3 days and said that's just what they would have done if they had been rich men like Joe Starks. Anyhow, a free mule in town was something new to talk about. Starks piled fodder under the big tree near the porch, and the mule was usually around the store like the other citizens. Nearly everybody took the habit of fetching along a handful of fodder to throw on the pile. He almost got fat, and they took a great pride in him. New lies sprung up about his free mule doings, how he pushed open Lindsay's kitchen door and slept in the place one night and fought until they made coffee for his breakfast. How he stuck his head in the Pearson's window while the family was at the table, and Mrs. Pearson mistook him for Reverend Pearson and handed him a plate. He ran Mrs. Tully off to the croquet ground for having such an ugly shape. He ran and caught up with Becky Anderson on the way to Maitland so as to keep his head out of the sun under her umbrella. He got tired of listening to Redmond's long-winded prayer and went inside the Baptist church and broke up the meeting. He did everything but let himself be bridled and visit Matt Bonner. But way after a while, he died. Lum found him under the big tree on his raw, bony back with all 4 feet up in the air. That wasn't natural and it didn't look right, but Sam said it would have been more unnatural for him to have laid down on his side and died like any other beast. He had seen death coming and had stood his ground and fought it like a natural man. He had fought it to the last breath. Naturally, he didn't have time to straighten himself out. Death had to take him like it found him. When the news got around, it was like the end of a war or something like that. Everybody that could knocked off from work to stand around and talk. But finally, there was nothing to do but drag him out like all other dead brutes, drag him out to the edge of the hammock, which was far enough off to satisfy sanitary conditions in the town. The rest was up to the buzzards. Everybody was going to the dragging out. The news had got Mayor Starks out of bed before time. His pair of gray horses was out under the tree, and the men were fooling with the gear when Janie arrived at the store with Joe's breakfast.
"My God, Lum, you fasten up this store good before you leave, you hear me?"
He was eating fast and talking with one eye out of the door on the operations.
"What you telling them to fasten up for, Jody?"
Janie asked, surprised.
"'Cause it won't be nobody here to look after the store. I'm going to the dragon out myself."
"'Tain't nothing so important I got to do today, Jody. How come I can't go along with you to the dragon out?"
Joe was struck speechless for a minute.
"Why, Janie, you wouldn't be seen in a dragon out, would you? With any and everybody in a passel, pushing and shoving, within no man of selves? No, no.
You would be there with me, wouldn't you?"
"That's right, but I'm a man, even if I isn't the mayor. But the mayor's wife is something different again. Anyhow, there's liable to need me to say a few words over the caucus, this being a special case. But you ain't going off in all that mess of commonness. I'm surprised at you for asking."
He wiped his lips of ham gravy and put on his hat.
"Shut the door behind you, Janie. Lum is too busy with the horses."
After more shouting of advice and orders and useless comments, the town escorted the caucus off. No, the caucus moved off with the town and left Janie standing in the doorway. Out in the swamp, they made great ceremony over the mule. They mocked everything human in death. Starks led off with a great eulogy on our departed citizen, our most distinguished citizen, and the grief he left behind him, and the people loved his speech. It made him more solid than building the schoolhouse had done. He stood on the distended belly of the mule for a platform and made gestures. When he stepped down, they hoisted Sam up, and he talked about the mule as a schoolteacher first. Then he set his hat like John Pearson and imitated his preaching. He spoke of the joys of mule heaven to which the dear brother had departed this valley of sorrow, the mule angels flying around, the miles of green corn and cool water, a pasture of pure bran with a river of molasses running through it. And most glorious of all, no mad bunner with plow lines and halters to come in and corrupt. Up there, mule angels would have people to ride on, and from his place beside the glittering throne, the dear departed brother would look down into hell and see the devil plowing mad bunner all day long in a hell-hot sun and laying the rawhide to his back. With that, the sisters got mock-happy and shouted and had to be held up by the menfolks. Everybody enjoyed themselves to the highest. And then finally, the mule was left to the already impatient buzzards. They were holding a great flying meet way up over the heads of the mourners, and some of the nearby trees were already peopled with the stoop-shouldered forms. As soon as the crowd was out of sight, they closed in circles. The near ones got nearer, and the far ones got near. A circle, a swoop, and a hop with spread-out wings. Close in, till some of the more hungry or daring perched on the carcass. They wanted to begin, but the parson wasn't there. So a messenger was sent to the ruler in a tree where he sat. The flock had to wait the white-headed leader, but it was hard. They jostled each other and pecked at heads in hungry irritation. Some walked up and down the beast from head to tail, tail to head. The parson sat motionless in a dead pine tree about 2 miles off. He had scented the matter as quickly as any of the rest, but decorum demanded that he sit oblivious until he was notified. Then he took off with ponderous flight and circled and lowered, until the others danced in joy and hunger at his approach. He finally lit on the ground and walked around the body to see if it were really dead. peered into its nose and mouth, examined it well from end to end, and leaped upon it and bowed, and the others danced a response. That being over, he balanced and asked,
"What killed this man?"
The chorus answered,
Bear fat."
"What killed this man?"
Bear fat."
"What killed this man?"
Bear fat."
"Who'll stand his funeral?"
"We."
"But all right now."
So he picked out the eyes in the ceremonial way, and the feast went on. The yellow mule was gone from the town except for the porch talk and for the children visiting his bleaching bones now and then in the spirit of adventure. Joe returned to the store, full of pleasure and good humor. But he didn't want Janie to notice it because he saw that she was sullen, and he resented that. She had no right to be, the way he thought things out. She wasn't even appreciative of his efforts, and she had plenty cause to be. Here he was, just pouring honor all over her, building a high chair for her to sit in and overlook the world, and she here pouting over it. Not that he wanted anybody else, but just too many women would be glad to be in her place. He ought to box her jaws. But he didn't feel like fighting today, so he made an attack upon her position, backhand.
"I had to laugh at the people out there in the woods this morning, Janie. You can't help but laugh at the capers they cuts. But all the same, I wish my people would get more business in them and not spend so much time on foolishness."
"Everybody can't be like you, Jody. Somebody's bound to want to laugh and play. Who don't love to laugh and play? Well, you make out like you don't anyhow."
"Ah, God, I don't make out no such a lie. But it's time for all things. But it's awful to see so many people don't want nothing but a full belly and a place to lay down and sleep afterwards. It makes me sad sometimes, and then again it makes me mad.
They say things sometimes that tickles me nearly to death, but I won't laugh just to disencourage them." Janie took the easy way away from a fuss. She didn't change her mind, but she agreed with her mouth. Her heart said, "Even so, but you don't have to cry about it." But sometimes Sam Watson and Lige Moss forced a belly laugh out of Joe himself with their eternal arguments. It never ended because there was no end to reach. It was a contest in hyperbole and carried on for no other reason. Maybe Sam would be sitting on the porch when Lige walked up. If nobody was there to speak of, nothing happened. But if the town was there like on Saturday night, Lige would come up with a very grave air. Couldn't even pass the time of day for being so busy thinking. Then, when he was asked what was the matter, in order to start him off, he'd say,
"This question done by drove me crazy. And Sam, he knows so much into things, I want some information on the subject."
Walter Thomas was due to speak up and egg the matter on.
"Yeah, Sam always got more information than he know what to do with. He's bound to tell you whatever it is you wants to know."
Sam begins an elaborate show of avoiding the struggle. That draws everybody on the porch into it.
"How come you want me to tell you? You always claim God done met you around the corner and talked his inside business with you. 'Tain't no use in you asking me nothing. I'm questionizing you."
"Well, how you gonna do that, Sam, when I arrived this conversation myself? I'm asking you."
"Asking me what? You ain't told me the subject yet."
"Don't aim to tell you. I aims to keep you in the dark all the time. Now, if you smart like you let on, you can find out."
You scared to let me know what it is, because you know I'll tear it to pieces. You got to have a subject to talk from. Dewey can't talk. If a man ain't got no bounds, he ain't got no place to stop.
By this time, they are the center of the world.
Well, all right, then. Since you own up you ain't smart enough to find out what I'm talking about, I'll tell you. What is it that keeps a man from getting burnt on a red-hot stove? Caution or nature?
Shucks. I thought you had something hard to ask me. Walter can tell you that.
If the conversation is too deep for you, how come you don't tell me so you hush up? Walter can't tell me nothing of the kind. I'm an educated man. I keeps my arrangements in my hands. And if it kept me up all night long studying about it, Walter ain't liable to be no help to me. I needs a man like you.
And then again, Lige, I'm going to tell you. I'm going to run this conversation from a gnat hill to a lice. It's nature that keeps a man off a red-hot stove.
Uh-huh. I knowed you was gonna crawl up in that holler, but I aims to smoke you right out. Tain't no nature at all. It's caution, Sam.
Tain't no such a thing. Nature tells you not to fool with no red-hot stove, and you don't do it neither.
Listen, Sam, if it was nature, nobody wouldn't have to look out for babies touching stoves, would they? Because they just naturally wouldn't touch it. But they sure will. So it's caution.
No, it ain't. It's nature. Because nature makes caution. It's the strongest thing that God ever made now. Fact is, it's the only thing God ever made. He made nature, and nature made everything else.
No, nature didn't either. A whole heap of things ain't even been made yet.
But tell me something you know of that nature ain't made yet.
She ain't made it so you can ride a butt-headed cow and hold on to the horns.
Yeah, but that ain't your point.
Yeah, it is, too.
No, it ain't neither.
Well, what is my point?
You ain't got none so far.
Yeah, it is, too, Walter cut in. The red-hot stove is his point.
He know mighty much, but he ain't proved it yet. Sam, I say it's caution, not nature, that keeps folks off a red-hot stove.
How is the sun going to be before his paw? Nature is the first of everything. Ever since Seth was Seth, nature been keeping folks off red-hot stoves. That caution you talk about ain't nothing but a humbug. He's an insect that nothing he got belongs to him. He got eyes like something else, wings like something else, everything. Even his hum is the sound of somebody else.
Man, what you talking about? Caution is the greatest thing in the world. If it wasn't for caution...
Show me something that caution ever made. Look what nature took and done. Nature got so high in her black hen, she got to lay a white egg. Now you tell me, how come what got into man that he got to have hair around his mouth? Nature.
That ain't the... The porch was boiling now. Starks left the store to Hezekiah Potts, the delivery boy, and come took a seat in his high chair.
Look at that great big old scoundrel beast up there at Hall's filling station. A great big old scoundrel. He eats up all the folks out of the house and then eat the house.
Oh, Tim was such a vomit nowhere that can eat no house. That's a lie. I was there yesterday, and I ain't seen nothing like that. Where is he?
I didn't see him, but I reckon he is in the backyard someplace. But they got his picture out front there. They was netting it up when I come past there this evening.
Well, all right now. If he eats up houses, how come he don't eat up the filling station?
That's 'cause they got him tied up so he can't. They got a grippy old picture telling how many gallons of that Sinclair high-compression gas he drank at one time and how he more than 1 million years old. 'Tain't nothing no million years old.
The picture's right up there where everybody can see it. They can't make the picture till they see the thing, Kendi.
How they gonna tell he's a million years old? Nobody wasn't born that far back.
By the rings on his tail, I reckon. Man, these white folks got ways for telling anything they wants to know.
Well, where he been all this time, then?
They caught him over there in Egypt. Seemed like he used to hang around there and eat up them pharaoh's tombstones. They got the picture from doing it. Nature is high in a vomit like that. Nature and salt. That's what makes a strong man like Big John the Conqueror. He was a man with salt in him. He could give a flavor to anything.
Yeah, but he was a man that was more than man. Tain't no more like him. He wouldn't dig potatoes and he wouldn't rake hay. He wouldn't take a whooping and he wouldn't run away.
Oh, yeah, somebody else could if they tried hard enough. Me, myself, I got salt in me. If I like man flesh, I could eat some man every day. Some of them is so trashy, they let me eat them.
Lord, I love to talk about Big John. Lest we tell lies on old John. But here come Bootsy and Titi and Big Woman down the street, making out they are pretty by the way they walk. They've got that fresh, new taste about them, like young mustard greens in the spring. And the young men on the porch are just bound to tell them about it and buy them some treats.
Here come my order right now,
Charlie Jones announces and scrambles off the porch to meet them. But he has plenty of competition, a pushing, shoving show of gallantry. They all beg the girls to just buy anything they can think of. Please let them pay for it. Joe is begged to wrap up all the candy in the store and order more. All the peanuts and soda water, everything.
Gal, I'm crazy about you.
Charlie goes on to the entertainment of everybody. I'll do anything in the world except work for you and give you my money. The girls and everybody else help laugh. They know it's not courtship. It's acting out courtship, and everybody is in the play. The three girls hold the center of the stage till Daisy Blunt comes walking down the street in the moonlight.